Welcome to the Diversity Remix, only provocative conversations at the intersection of business, politics, and culture. I'm Charlie Echeverry.
And I'm Jesus Chavez.
This week's episode, does winning no longer matter? In our deep dive today, Simone Biles has dominated gymnastics in recent history, winning 4 Olympic gold medals and 19 world championships. She hasn't lost a major competition since 2013. But she's been marred in controversy this Olympics due to her decision to withdraw from the Games. We'll have a look at the various players in that decision and what it means for her legacy and for Olympic competition in general. And in Courage or Cringe, Ben and Jerry's blacklisted, Scarlett Johansson sues Disney, and Spotify claims editorial neutrality. Do states have a right to regulate their purchases to protect the interests of an American ally? Or are they overreaching when they penalize companies for issues on the global stage? Is an A-list lawsuit against a major media company evidence of elitist sour grapes for not making millions more on an already fat contract? Or is it an example of a corporation using COVID as an excuse to breach a contract that helped increase its share price? And finally, is a leading audio platform's leadership taking a bold step in solidifying free speech on its platform? Or is the CEO passing on the responsibility to navigate between fact and fiction to its consumers? All this week on TDR.
Just sit here and whisper into the microphone for an hour and a half. See what happens when I turn the gain up really high.
That is creepy.
Isn't it creepy?
It is creepy.
Yeah, but nevertheless,
it's a thing.
It's an entire category of content like on YouTube. So we are going to do the entire show in ASMR. That's not for real, but I thought I just could test out the game. This first story is actually super interesting too. Mm-hmm. Because it's one of those stories that I've read now 3 or 4 times and I've changed my perspective on it like 8 times. In the story.
Yeah.
Like I came out with a defined point of view. It was a knee-jerk thing. I was like, this...
I don't think we ever talked about it, which is perfect.
No, I know. Like, this is the way it is. It means this. Then I started digging into it deeper, and I was like, actually, no. I think it means this. And then I flipped again. So it's a very interesting story, and so I'm glad we're doing it on our deep dive.
Have you watched much of the Olympics?
I have, but this is another topic that I think is interesting. I've watched all of it. On Roku, they do an Olympics recap. Like it's a shelf that they built for content. And so if you just open up 2021 Olympics, they give you like 3-minute clips of like all the different sports and they summarize the whole thing.
Oh, I have Roku TV. Yeah, I haven't actually done that.
I haven't watched a single thing actually happen live. And I don't have TV, but the bigger point that it brings up for me is, do we need sports to be live anymore? Because in my own life, I don't watch sports live anymore.
Yeah, although I think it's tough on... Yeah.
I never thought I'd like it, but I end up that I it actually doesn't matter as much as I thought it would.
Well, in the case of Olympics, it's actually, I think, is really helpful when it's not live because there is so much that is happening all within a short period of time that it makes it much easier to kind of go back and forth. And even some of those events take a long time, even though the actual participation is really short. Like gymnastics, a lot of waiting around.
Yeah.
Track and field is a perfect example of sitting around forever.
Mm-hmm.
I think I told you this, but when I was in college, my girlfriend at the time was a runner. She was her and her sister did like the 4x100. She was on the 100 or 200, I'm blanking out, and also the long jump.
Were you a runner in college too?
Or No, not at all. No, not even a little bit. I got the freshman 50 or whatever, I put on.
I think it's the freshman 10, Jesus. You may have gone a little overboard with your pound gainage.
Yeah. I definitely
freshman
defeated
50.
That. Yeah, I cruised right through that 10-pound mark.
It's a big boy.
But yeah, but you go to these events and you're just sitting there just waiting around forever to see the event. So I think from a perspective, I could totally see. I still think the best moment, at least one of the best moments, did you see the high jump final? It's a great video. Just look it up. There's basically, these guys were battling, right? And the two of the top three were from Qatar and from Italy, right? These guys were doing high jumps. And they kept on, basically got all of their jumps until they got to the very last height, which frankly, I forget what it is, right? And once they got to the final height, neither one of them was able to clear it, and they get like three chances, I guess, right? And at the end of it, after the Italian guy went second and he wasn't able to clear it, and it was their first miss for both of them. Like, they had gotten all their jumps up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the judge comes up to them and tells them, hey, like, look, we can do a jump off kind of thing. You know, we can figure it out, right?
That's a thing?
I guess. So, I mean, when
they had the exact same height, basically.
Well, yeah, because they both were tied, right? Hit every single height.
Usually that level of...
Until they got to that final height, and then they both missed it.
Right. I guess what I'm saying is, as a sport, that's one of those rare sports where the bar literally is set at a number, and you either exceed it or you don't. Whereas in other track and field sports, you can go a millimeter farther. Usually that's the difference between first and second place.
That's right. So they're setting it. And the guy from Qatar said, like, well, can we have two golds? Can we both get gold? And the
judge, very millennial.
And the judge, like... Yeah, well, yeah, actually you can. And they both looked at each other and, you know, they agreed, they're on the spot, and they both got gold. It's like the best sporting scene that I've seen in such a long time.
Yeah, but
it
says bronze so much about... But then is bronze silver?
No, so there's a bronze, of course, right?
So there's two golds and one bronze.
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
I would have complained if I was the bronze. I would have wanted the silver.
Yeah, he didn't earn it. I thought it was such an awesome moment of competitiveness, because these guys have been perfect until that moment,
mm-hmm.
right? They were doing, you know, a hell of a job, and also of like, you know, of actually like celebrating the sport.
And so, yes.
And in both cases, I believe for both countries, I want to say it was the first time either country had gotten gold in the high jump. So it was just a beautiful scene, right?
A moment of symbolism that can change hearts and minds.
There you go. So it was awesome. It was awesome to see that.
And I got you beat, though. There's another one.
That stood out to me with my favorite moment so far.
I didn't see it, but I saw the clip of it, of the guy who apparently got as like a 1,500 or 5,000 meter run, one of the long ones. And the guy, I think he was Ethiopian, it was East African, whatever it was, he got confused and thought the race was over, like, because you hit some benchmark and he just slowed down. And the guy behind him, who was a Spaniard, started yelling at him to keep going because he hadn't hit the finish line. He was number two.
Right.
He's like, no, keep going. But the guy didn't speak Spanish. So he finally like pushed him. He's like, you got to go across the line instead of overtaking the guy and getting first. So I thought that was kind
of
nice.
I've seen a couple of versions of those in the running set where people have done that. Yeah, okay. Which is pretty cool.
Why is it easy to – how's it – like you would think it wouldn't be easy to get confused.
Yeah, well, I've seen versions of that mostly like in, I forget what I was watching. It might have been a triathlon or one of those, right?
Yeah.
Where someone just took the wrong turn and they were winning and they were going to win. And the guy was like, hey, you just... And when they interviewed the guy afterwards, he said, listen, I was in no scenarios I'm going to lose. Like, this guy had already beaten me and he was just making a mistake. So I just didn't think it was right for me to win that way.
Yeah. I could see not wanting to win that way too.
Yeah, yeah.
Although I don't know what I would have done in the moment. What would you have done in the moment? You think you would have just kept running?
No, I think it will be that kind of scenario, especially when you're at that competing at that level and you're that far in front and it's clear that the person beating you is going to win. Not if it was like a super tight one. I think it's the kind of thing mm-hmm. where even you may win and still get the medal, but everyone knows, in starting with you, that you didn't deserve it.
It relates to the Simone Biles situation in a way, because it brings up how much should... the intangibles of the sport. In this case, comprehension of the rules. I mean, yeah, I get it, you got confused. I could get confused about throwing the javelin a particular way and lose, but my confusion caused that and I'm still disqualified. So it does, in a way, relate to this Simone Biles thing that has a lot of intangibles tied into actual physical performance.
I think it's a little bit different in these kind of more like races where it's developing as you're in it and you as a competitor realize that the other person is making a mistake. It's not because they're hurt or anything else or that you're beating them, right? That I could totally see people reacting that way, which I think is awesome when that happens. But this moment with the high jumpers, I think, was just so great. A, for the fact that it wasn't even like brought up as an option, they even had to ask. And I guess I read a little mini interview of the athlete from Qatar, and he said that him and the Italian guy are actually like, they're really good friends, even outside of the sport.
Well, there was
a moment there of like, hey, listen, like we've done our part, we did everything we had to do, and like at this point, like why not share in the glory? And I thought it was like such a beautiful moment.
But it's interesting. You wonder how much of that, like, apparently they made the decision on the spot, but how much of that is precedential? I mean, does that mean that now if there's ever a tie that they can have that that option to both get golds, and you know what I mean.
Like, I'm guessing that was always an option in those kind of scenarios.
Yeah, I never heard of
right?
it.
Right, and maybe just doesn't. It rarely happens because I think what made it unique is that neither one had a fault the entire time leading up to that moment. And what I think the way that they do it, if I remember correctly, is that if someone has a fault, even if they clear the same distance, the same height, I'm sorry, then they get ranked as lower in terms of their...
Right. You deduct from their overall performance.
Right, because they've already made a mistake. Right? In this case, they hadn't. And I think that's why it was that they were actually tied. And maybe that doesn't happen as often as we would think.
Interesting. But it does, in any case, bring to mind this very interesting situation with Simone Biles, who very famously kind of recused herself from the Olympics. I guess initially not all of it, but then sort of eventually she just started withdrawing from different events. Right?
Yeah, initially she withdrew from the team event. That's what she first withdrew from. But yeah, there's so much about her in this story. And what was interesting, we were going to talk about this even before we got into the withdrawing, right? Because there was all this controversy around the scoring of her events. Right. And look, I don't think we need to recap too much about the race of her because I think she's obviously people know a lot about her, I think. But she's been super dominant, you know, over like the last 8 years. She's won 4 Olympic golds, just got a bronze in this last event that she did was the balance beam. But before that, had 4 Olympic golds and had 19 world championship medals. Right. And actually had, I read this, that was hilarious. She has 4 maneuvers named after her. When you have maneuvers named after you, like you are kicking so much butt at that point, right?
You are styling. I can't imagine the equivalent in another sport, like I don't know, you know, like a soccer move. Actually, there are a couple. There's a very famous soccer move called the Cruyff, which is named after Johan Cruyff, who is a Dutch forward, and he did that like one move where you kind of like bring the ball behind your back as a way to kind of like make the guy break his ankles.
Uh-huh.
But it's extremely rare to have like a move named after you.
Especially
you have to be
4 of them.
Especially for him. I don't know a lot about you. I was hoping you could educate me on the gymnastics. Yeah, I know you know more about it.
By the way, just to go back to her dominance, she hasn't lost in any major competition since her debut in 2013. That's when people say she's the GOAT. It's like, this woman is super dominant. Super dominant, right? So, look, the first part, and we'll talk about her withdrawing, but let's talk a little bit about the initial kind of controversy that was happening in the Olympics as it relates to her, right? One was there was a scoring controversy that had been coming up, and something that has actually had come up from before, not even just related to this Olympics. But just to give a quick overview in terms of how this worked, right? So typically, their score on any event of a gymnast is the combination of their execution of that you know event, which is graded out of a perfect 10, and the difficulty level of the starting value score, right? So the harder it is that they're performing, the more their total they can actually perform. And that's not just for gymnastics. They do that a lot for, if you ever watched a high dive, sort of same thing, right? Yeah. They all sort of take a similar approach where like they know what you're going to perform, which I think helps the judges
prepare for what
they're going to score.
But honestly,
and the more complex it is, the more your total score can be on that event. Right?
I didn't know about this, and I thought it was really interesting because most of the time when you perform, the rules are already written. But in this case, you're kind of writing the rules because you have to tell them what you're going to do. In other words, I'm going to do this. So the expectation is in the judge's head, this is a X level difficulty thing.
Correct.
And so it's a combination of the thing I choose to do and how I do it.
Right.
That gives you my score.
And that's part of the strategy piece, right? Because you've seen it in some of these cases. As a matter of fact, I was watching the men's floor routine. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's called floor routine as well, but the one that they do on the floor. And,
yeah, I think it is a floor routine.
We were watching it with my daughter this weekend, mm-hmm. and the athlete from China, he was like flawless in what he did. Like the dude just nailed everything, but he like barely got third place. And they were talking about it like, yeah, but he chose like a fairly safe route. He just did it with like very little faults. And it was the guy from Israel, which I think was also the first time. I don't know if it's the first time Israel Eller has won the men's individual floor routine, but it was it's kind of in that. He definitely made more mistakes, but he just all the moves he was making were just harder to do, right? And still, of course, did it well enough where he ended up getting gold. But that was a perfect example of that, right? And the challenge with someone like, or part of the thing with someone like Simone is that not only was she performing more difficult moves, but she was doing really, really well. So she's killing people in the starting score and then doing really well with them. So therefore she like basically really, really, you know, gets ahead of everybody else. She was so dominant, which is, and I read this and I was like, that's crazy. At the World Championship, she won by more than 2 points, which is like, oh, what's 2 points? Well, the typical wins are decided by tenths and hundredths of a point. She like completed one. Yeah. Yeah.
Like the decimal point in the wrong place. For
exactly,
her.
Right.
Wow.
So on two of the events, she was getting what people believe was being underscored, right? One of those events was in the vault, right? Where she was doing this three complete flips, something that apparently only a few men can even perform, let alone
male athletes,
let alone the female athletes, right? And then the second was this dismount that she would do from the balance beam, which is this double twist, double back move, right? And then part of that also translated to like her strength in the floor routines, right? Because she's like obviously does a lot of stuff in the floor routine as well, right? So this is something that a lot of people felt that could be scored a lot higher for her, but they weren't being scored as high by the IGF, which is, I guess, the International Gymnastics Federation, but I'm guessing, right? And they were basically underscoring these moves, and people were calling up, like, why is she not getting a higher starting point of the score? And really, the IGF had no explanation, right? Now, there was a piece by the New York Times of which they said that one of the reasons that they inferred was a safety issue, right? And part of it is, like, at least the rationale being that IGF sort of say, like, look, if we give you a lower starting point of the score, that what it should be, maybe higher, it actually reduces the incentive for other athletes to try this that where they could be potentially be hurt. But that sounds like that's super messed up thinking here, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, and of course for Simone Biles, her point of view is that look, I'm being underscored to try to keep this more competitive. Because otherwise people know that I'm crushing
everyone.
You're
gonna just dominate.
Now in part of those complaints, there's also been, this is something that has happened before this Olympics, is there's been this complaint from the international community that in general, U.S. gymnasts are just more athletic, right? And that based on the current rules, are being scored much higher on tumbling competition that gives them an overall edge on the event, right? Because especially when they do the overall event for individuals, they take the collective score, right? And say they're just scoring so much higher in the tumbling events that it makes it hard for everybody else. And some of that complaint, by the way, it turned pretty racist pretty quickly, right? So in 2013, there was an Italian gymnast, and I don't have her name here in front of me, but she and her teammates, she said basically that she and her teammates should have donned blackface in order to win, right? And there was a spokesperson that came out from the team that said, look, that basically—
The Italian girl said that?
Yeah, yeah. So basically said—
Sounds wrong.
Yeah, sounds kind of wrong. He said, look, he said, the code of points is opening chances for colored people known to be more powerful and penalizing the typical Eastern European elegance, right? So it kind of goes to this point. And it was actually very similar comments made by the current coach of Brazil's women's team, who also was saying, like, look, because black basically athletes are more powerful, they're getting an edge as it relates to some of these events. So there is both a combination of people complaining that the overall scoring system, they're putting too much weight in some of these tumbling-based events that benefit more these type of athletes, and then specifically going after Simone Biles because of her dominance, and the judges sort of, you know, messing with the scoring to try to keep it somewhat competitive.
Yeah.
Which is all super messed up.
My initial take when I heard this was, you know, and like part of it was how it was framed, right? Simone Biles, who is the greatest of all time. In fact, she's so great, she's got no problem wearing a goat on her leotard, right? So it's like, that's how great she is. I don't know if she was given it or she wore it herself.
I've never seen that.
She's got little goats on her leotard, right? Great. She clearly is, right? Yeah, So, and the way it was framed was, well, she kind of like steps back from this competition because of her mental health and yada, yada. My first thought was, and this is what I'm telling you, I'm like, and I'm you can jump in. I'm not going to like soliloquy, but my point was that my initial take was, you know, there used to be a time when sports was precisely overcoming your mental and physical and all these limitations to become great. So the whole point was you will be tried mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually. Right. And that is what ultimate, and especially Olympic and international athletics is about, is despite that, and you go through all the historical examples of the girl, I forget when it was, maybe in the early thousands, when that rolled her ankle and she's out there and she's doing it with like her ankles like dangling off and somebody right. else, their dad just died. And nevertheless, they go and they perform because that's the point, is that's how you achieve greatness. So I was very like thinking, you know, here's a woman who's wearing the goat on her leotard and nevertheless, she walks out. And I think about like, who was the person that could have made the trip that didn't because she took the sure. position? So I was pretty negative on that. Then I started reading.
You were pretty negative on the initial reaction on her pulling out of the team.
My initial reaction was negative toward her.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? Uh-huh. Then I got to reading about this IOC or whatever the organization is. Again, we've been talking about some of these organizations lately. And the fact that they literally were kind of watering down or dumbing down the levels to set them for her, kind of like EQing it for her, going, well, I know this is really hard, but for you, it's not as hard. So we're not going to give you the same thing. And I was like, what in the hell is that about?
Right.
Because if anything, if she's just dominating that, like you have generational talent, right? I thought about it in the case of basketball. It's like, you're going to say, well, listen, you can slam too easy on a 10. So we're going to give you a point and a half.
Right.
When you score, it's just too easy. You're too tall. You get a point and a half. The short guy's going to get two. And if you're really short, you get three if you slam.
Right.
It just changes the entire dynamic of the sport, right? And then I started thinking more about that. And I was like, no, screw it. They're wrong.
Yeah.
And then kind of where I'm at now is this idea of maybe they both need to do a little bit of work, right? Because to me, the idea of the greatness and performing anyway, even in spite of these issues and the fact that you're stressed or whatever, that's part of what defines greatness. And then the other side is like these folks are just, it's like the helicopter parent equivalent of Olympic judges, right? It's like we're trying to just lower the bar so that everybody can feel like, you know,
better.
A little bit better. And that's just not what this sports is about at all.
No, I agree with you. I think there are a couple of different things that you're speaking to. You know, I guess let's get into a little bit in terms of the why she says she's pulled out, right? So she says she pulled out because to focus on her mental health, which you mentioned. And I think in part of that, she talked about the reason why she felt that was really important because she was experiencing this thing, just call, I guess, the twisties, which could come up with a probably worse name for something, but the twisties, right? Which is this thing that happens to, I guess, the gymnast, where there is this disconnect between what the mind and body, between the mind and the body that causes these gymnasts to become disoriented as they're in midair during these skills. And for someone like her that does these very complicated in-air kind of movements,
it could be more dangerous.
It could be a lot more dangerous than anything else. So, I apparently that's a real thing, and other gyms have talked about it in terms of this whole thing about the twisties, right? When I first saw the thing about her pulling out, it definitely was super disappointing because of all, of course, all the expectations. But I could also, I saw it much more from the perspective of she was, something was wrong with her in this whole Olympics. When she did her first, the qualifiers the day before, right before like the actual, she did okay, but she like fell off from the high beam. Or the balance beam, not high beam, the balance beam. And there was something else that she did where in her floor routine, she kind of went off the area, even though, and she still did fine, because once again, her performance is so much more complicated than people that she still did well enough to
advance.
Help, yeah. Advance. But you could already see that there was something kind of wrong that was happening. And then during the day of the team competition, I forgot which one is the one that she fell from. I think it might have been the balance beam again that she fell from. And at that point, she goes back to the locker room and it comes back and says, hey guys, like I need to pull out. Like I'm just not in the right kind of mental state. On the one hand, I definitely can understand to some degree the perspective people have of like, hey, but this is what being an athlete is all about. It's about rising to these moments and surpassing this. My first orientation was like, I thought of much more from a teammate and thinking about playing with people that are super talented. But if something is wrong, that they're just not performing, like how many people would have the courage to say, hey, I just, today, guys, I don't have it. Like, it's not there. I already saw yesterday, I'm like, I'm not there. Like, you know what I can do, and I'm not delivering.
And we have good athletes
here that can take my spot right now so that we don't miss out on this opportunity because I am, like, not here. Because the more common example that you will see is that they'll be like, no, 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 I got it. I'll do it. And you've seen plenty of those selfish, you know, athletes that will take the whole team down with them because they're having a bad shooting night and they shoot up, continue to shoot through. You miss whatever be the case. And I thought it much more from that perspective when I first saw this happen as it relates to the team. I could definitely appreciate the fact that, hey, if you thought something was wrong before you got there, would this been a spot that someone else could have performed in? But also thinking about the sport, like this is a sport that requires like complete dedication.
And maybe the bulk of the evidence would be on this side of the on your side of the ledger with respect to her specifically, because here's somebody who's performed at the highest level for years under tremendous pressure, and she's always kind of delivered, right? So it's not like, oh, now finally you get on a big stage and you kind of choke.
Or someone that like, oh, you have no will, weak will. Person, well,
right?
No,
she hasn't
dominated the sport so badly.
There's no evidence of that, right? There hasn't been any evidence. So I give you that. I think that she probably, that it would be realistic to say she's legitimately just sensing, as athletes can, about themselves, I'm just not in the right place. Now, you could also say, no, it's because she's hasn't lost since 2013 or whatever the status that you gave,
right.
that she realized she was, and even though she could perform, she didn't want to lose, so she pulled out. Like, you could play that too.
Yeah, you could, but pulling out of the, I think that would have, yeah, that's interesting. The challenge here is not just her losing in this case. If she loses for the whole team for
yeah.
the whole team, right? And the question becomes is like, can someone else come in there and perform and put the team in a good place? Look, I think gymnastics as a sport is one of the hardest one in terms of the toll that it takes on people and the amount of time and effort you got to dedicate to these things. I just had a really hard time believing that someone who has spent so much of their life in the sport and then getting to the biggest moment, and who has shown over, you know, now almost, you know, I guess what is 8 years of performing at the very highest level, doesn't have the gut to stick out a tough situation. Like, because a lot of people make so many claims about her, like being a coward. And I'm like, I don't know how you put it on someone that has been so dominant.
Right.
Like, that is like a coward. Like, I don't think it's a coward.
Yeah, you have to look at all the evidence and all their history. And again, that's seems where hard I can to see believe. That to you.
Mm-hmm. That seems hard to believe. And it's the kind of thing, like, you know, she came back fine. Because not only did she pull out of the team event, she pulled out of all the overall individual, which is the big one, where she was definitely expected to win gold there. And that, I think, out of all of us, probably the one that personally cost her the most, because that is her legacy. Like, getting the overall goal, she would have been the first woman, I think, to win back-to-back goals in the overall event as an individual. And I don't think it's ever happened in history, right? Like, that would have been a really big... And she still didn't feel like she was in good enough place to be able to compete at that. Now, maybe there you can make a little bit of an argument of, maybe she thought that she didn't quite have it, so she was going to get a silver instead of a gold, so then she pulled out. But... then why pull out before? I mean, that's putting a lot of if-then statements.
I think you can make an argument that she already has a legacy if the worst thing she's worried about is getting a silver. Do you know what I mean? Like, but like silver, it reminds me of the old saying that second place is the first loser. You know, in her case, like when the expectation is so high, you're going to set some new world record. No one's going to come within two decimal points of you.
Right.
You haven't lost in 8 years. Everything is a goal that you touch. You're wearing a goat on your leotard. I mean, like, man, it's like...
Well, and what's interesting
is
even the event that she chose to come back to, it was the final event, right, of gymnastics. And an event that I want to say that in 2016, she also got the bronze. So it's not one that she's, like, fully dominated.
Got it, okay.
So it was interesting to have her come back to that event at the very, very end to try to compete. And she ended up getting the bronze in that event. So... at least there you can say maybe she knows that she, you know, there was a chance that she could still not win a gold and still decided to come out there and perform anyways. To me, the reaction has been really interesting.
Yeah,
man. I mean, people are like super brutal on her. Like, she's like betrayed her country and like, what are you, like,
yeah, that's
what are you talking about?
Like, way over the top.
You know, there's so much of that.
And I don't, you know, just to kind of close this out for me is, you know, I do, my hope is that, we can always remember that the idea of, you know, sports is obviously physical fitness, health, mental and physical, et cetera. All those things are part of it. But the reason that we do sport, the reason we compete with ourselves and with others is so that we can rise above, so that we can achieve new things. And so, you know, to the extent that this dissuaded somebody from doing that, I'm sorry that it did. But I don't think that you should place the blame on her, certainly not overwhelmingly, although, like I said, I do hope that we don't ever lose sight of the fact that that's part of the beauty of sport.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the second thing is, again, for me, these guys, like, we just need to set the rules. If somebody dominates, they're dominant. They're dominant. That's what makes them dominate.
You know what I thought about when I heard that part?
Just is, leave it alone.
I was hearing an interview that Joe Rogan was doing with Matt Frazier, right? So for those that aren't familiar, Matt Frazier is a CrossFit guy. He just retired last year and, you know, has been the most dominant male in recent history, maybe ever, I think, probably
ever,
in CrossFit.
Ever, historically.
I think he won, what, 5 years in a row?
Five in a row,
right.
Which in that sport is, I mean...
Yeah, it's super... But not only was he winning, he was like dominating, right? And I remember in that interview, he talked about, and he was talking some smack about the guy who programs CrossFit, what's his name?
Dave Castro.
Dave Castro, thank you. Saying that that basically this guy was trying to program things into the events, specifically trying to find a way to bring
events
them closer
for taller
into
athletes,
into like the mix.
Sure, a lot
pull
more
them back
Murphs
into the mix, right?
Or, so burpees, things like that.
So that stuff happened. And right, what's interesting is like we just at the same time as
but
the
that
Olympics,
just doesn't penalize him though. That penalizes all other shorter athletes, stuff like that. So it's not
for,
just
for sure. But you can totally see, yeah. But maybe it doesn't matter, right? Maybe at that point is you're trying to get this guy that's so dominant,
right,
to get closer. You don't care if there's other kind of casualties in the process, right?
Correct. But to make this equivalent, it would be like, okay, Matt, when you clean and jerk 250 pounds, we're not going to give you the same credit as when somebody else clean and jerks 250 pounds. It's still 250. You just get less points for
right,
it.
Right. But
that would be the equivalent.
Yeah.
Here.
You're right. The difference here is because she does, Simone Biles does routines and does moves that other people just don't even attempt. Right. And
but
just getting like the last
and Matt
points.
Fraser lifts things faster and heavier than most people can lift. But
right.
That's not his fault. Just like
for
it's
sure.
not her
I
fault.
Completely agree, right? Yeah. But I'm just giving it as a point of comparison where that stuff does actually happen.
Sure.
And even right now, at the same time as the Olympics is going on, the CrossFit Games once again happen. And on the women's side, who's also been super dominant, is
Tia Claire Toomey.
Tia Claire Toomey, who also just won, I think.
I would argue
fifth.
She's actually more dominant.
She's definitely, I mean, yeah, she's
well,
super
she's,
dominant.
Well,
she's more dominant now, I would say.
I guess,
she did not start off as being more, because she, like,
yeah.
The first couple of them, they were really close.
Yeah. No, let me qualify. I would argue that she's more dominant relative to the male, to her male class now. I don't know if she's
for
more
sure.
dominant than Fraser yet, but maybe, but you can make the case now.
This
and
last
if she wins
one,
again,
for
she will
sure.
be.
Sure.
Yeah.
She just won her fifth one, and she was like, I forgot, I mean, like 2,000 points, not 2,000, 200 points above. You know,
there's 15 events in the games. She won first place in 9 of them. The guy who won for the males only won 1 out of 15 events.
Right.
That tells you
just,
all that you have
yeah,
to need
yeah,
to know
yeah.
right there.
She was good. I'm sure. So maybe next year they'll change the events for women to try to get her to come back to the pack a little bit more.
Either that or just bring CrossFit into the Olympics and we're good. We combine all this,
that
all this
be,
stuff
that would be great.
Together. All right. Good conversation. We're moving on to Courage or Cringe. We've got, you know, ice cream and all kinds of stuff. What else? Scarlett Johansson. What do Scarlett Johansson, ice cream, and Spotify have in common? They're all on the show today.
Yes, exactly. So our first topic, Courage or Cringe, Florida and Texas threaten to blacklist Ben & Jerry for their decision to end sales of ice cream in the West Bank.
Haters. They just don't like ice cream.
Yeah. So a few weeks ago, on July 19th, Ben & Jerry announced that it will no longer sell its ice cream in Palestinian territories occupied in Israel.
Okay.
Now, immediately following their announcement, their move was condemned by some, including politicians, right, calling it as being anti-Israel and demanding lawmakers to sanction the company. By the way, Ben & Jerry's makes up about 75% of the premium ice cream market in Israel, right? So they're pretty dominant there. Now, part of the controversy here is that this move by Ben & Jerry is being framed by some as part of the of what is called a BDS movement, which is BDS stands for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, which started in 2005 and called for an economic, cultural, and academic boycott of Israel for its violations of international law and Palestinian rights, as well as its occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, right? So, which is something, by the way, that the company has not publicly supported, right? And even the founders of Ben & Jerry came out and said they did not endorse the BDS movement, nor did they see the company's efforts as a boycott of Israel. They're simply saying, we're pulling out of this area, we still want to operate in Israel, so we're not calling it a boycott of Israel in any way whatsoever, right? Now, they framed the company move, this is the co-founders, who, by the way, happen to be Jewish, both of them, is we see the company's recent action as part of a similar trajectory, not as anti-Israel, but part of a long history of being pro-peace, right?
That's very much on brand for them. Even
super
if it,
on brand.
Even
on brand
if it wasn't true, it's still on brand.
It is
that?
Very on brand for them. And they've been a very activist brand for a long time, right? So these are consistent there. Now, this BDS assignment is important because Israel has successfully lobbied some countries to condemn boycotts against it, right? So in Germany, the BDS movement is considered anti-Semitic. Right. In the UK, they're passing laws to curb boycotts against Israel. And in the US, there is 35 states that have passed anti-BDS laws. Right. Now, these laws typically limit state authorities from doing business with anyone who is actively boycotting Israel and prevents state pension funds from investing in BDS-linked companies.
Mm-hmm.
Which even that, the first time I heard that, that blew me away, that there will be state-level laws specifically dealing with how companies operate internationally, right?
So like I didn't. These 35 states, though, the part that was unclear to me is do we think that those anti-BDS laws are generally uniform across these 35 states? In other words, is it like the same
the
level?
The same law? Yeah, I don't know. That's a great point. That's a great point. They could vary. I'm sure they do because they're state laws. I'm sure they have maybe a little bit different language.
Right. But the general thrust.
The general thrust is the same. It's like, hey, if you as a corporation that are operating in this state are doing anything to try to boycott Israel, then we as a state can take action against you, right? And that action could be everything from, once again, preventing some of our funds of the state to investing in your kind of companies or find other ways to be able to literally blacklist you, right?
And 35 states, it's not a red-blue thing then because that's
yeah, I didn't see which, but yeah, but you're right. I mean, it's a big enough thing. It's just, to me, it is super interesting seeing that. Like that is—
Do you think part of it though is just the size of these state economies are significant enough where it matters or is just— Do you see what I'm saying? In other words, like California is always touting the fact that it's the 14th largest economy in the world. Well, if
maybe,
it is,
I mean, yeah, that's kind of interesting. It could be the case. Look, I think part of it has been for a very, very long time, the U.S. has been a very strong ally of Israel, right? And doing everything that it can to be able to support it because they see it as it's obviously its partner in a very complicated area of the world.
It's the only democracy in the Middle East.
So I think to that point, the U.S. has been very supportive in a bunch of different ways. And I'm sure part of this sort of came to like, how do we take that support and find all the ways that we can put pressure on anyone that tries to do any harm to the state of Israel, right? And that then translates to state laws to me. But I still have a really hard time understanding how we even got to the point of even looking at state laws as a vehicle to put pressure on social corporation.
Well, how old are these anti-BDS laws, though? Because my guess is they didn't just happen yesterday.
There's 35 of them, so they've been around for a while. Yeah,
I'm sure they have.
I don't know, right?
Yeah.
And so this is kind of why this I thought was a really interesting topic to talk about. Right?
My sense is this has something to do with the Jewish diaspora in the United States, too. Like, that's why I think that, I don't know about Texas, but that's why I think Florida, if you read what they actually said, and look, I've lived in Florida, so I know that there's a significant Jewish diaspora that lives in Florida. And so maybe that has something.
Yeah, maybe in some states, but 35? Like,
yeah,
that's
a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot. You know, so you're going to get some dynamic there, but that can be the whole driver, right? So, of course, now Florida and Texas jumped into this issue immediately, right? So in Florida, Governor DeSantis requested the Florida Board of Administration start by placing Ben & Jerry and Unilever, which is the parent company of Ben & Jerry, on a continued examination list of those companies, right? And in a letter he wrote, should the State Board of Administration affirmly place Unilever and its corporate entities on the scrutinized companies list, air quotes, right?
Yeah.
And these companies do not cease the boycott of Israel as required by Florida law, the board must refrain from acquiring any and all Unilever assets consistent with the law.
That's right? A lot of soap we're not going to buy now.
That's right.
The scrutinized companies list, I tried to look this up, I couldn't find it. That is a capitalized term in this thing, which means it's a legal term for the purposes of Florida.
And the law.
Do we know that the scrutinized companies list is shared by the 35 states?
I'm sure it isn't. No.
These
are all state level conversations, right? So every state has to determine
who is
that's why the whole
thing
is so interesting to me. It's like that's a really
so I could be on the scrutinized list in Texas but not in Florida.
Well, yeah, because I may not even be operating or have any headquarters or anything in a specific area. So actually, that's a great question. I don't know if you even have to operate or have offices in that market.
Well,
or simply
have
a distribution.
Unilever
right?
is not based in Florida.
Yeah, so I guess that's actually super interesting, right? The whole thing is very odd to me.
Okay.
Now, in Texas, they took a very similar approach, right? In terms of like putting them on this list to take a look at them, right? Once again, do this list match up? No idea, right? But I thought it was pretty hilarious, some of the comment that they said, which is like what they said. They added to that approach saying, it is worth noting that thankfully, Texans have much better options for a sweet treat this summer. Bluebell was founded in Berman, Texas, and tastes much better than the overpriced, stuck-up stuff made by a foreign-owned company started in Vermont.
Wow.
It's like
Bluebell actually is pretty good.
Bluebell is pretty good, yeah. I give him credit on that.
But I like the stuck-up stuff.
Yeah, just like, what are we talking about, you know?
Wow. Okay.
But
who said that, by the way? That's a quote.
That was a quote from the governor's office. I don't know if that came directly from the governor or not, but that was a quote from the governor's office,
okay.
Right? So, I mean, listen, we could talk about it more, but I just pause it here, right? So courage or cringe, states rightfully protecting the interests of an American ally, or state overreach penalizing companies for issues on the global stage.
Interesting.
Charlie, courage or cringe?
All right. So I'm not a fan of Ben and Jerry's. I love ice cream, by the way, but I'm not a fan of Ben and Jerry's for a very simple reason, maybe overly simplistic, but, in 2019, there was 125 or 130 companies that specifically put a big full page ad in the New York Times, mm-hmm. Explicitly signing their company as a signator to a pro-abortion legislation. Mm-hmm. So they weren't saying like, we're pro-choice and we're fine with people making their own decisions. They were explicitly making the case that they're pro-abortion. There's a few of them that I recall. A lot of the brands were no-name brands. Ben & Jerry was one. Mm-hmm. That's the last time I bought Ben & Jerry's. Anyway, but okay. And I do like ice cream. So for me that was kind of like tainting some of this, but let me punch through it a little bit, okay. a little bit deeper. I don't know if so this BDS assignment, I did look that up. It seems like it has a long and colorful history. There are a number of people who consider it mm-hmm. anti-Semitic. I can't speak with a tremendous amount of authority on whether or not it is, but there's enough concern that it may be. And a lot of them, the people who even are American progressives that I looked at that are against BDS, say that the reason they're against it, these are Jewish progressives, mm-hmm. the reason they're against it is because the BDS movement, according to them, is an end game to actually not recognize Israel. So in other words, that they use this as a ruse.
There's for sure lots of controversy with this BDS movement.
Right.
Yeah, completely
so,
agree.
So, and I looked at a few of these folks who wouldn't be ideological allies of mine, but nevertheless had a pro-Israel progressive view, and that was their big beef with it. So, mm-hmm.
You have multiple issues here, right?
Segments.
There is that. There is the BDS movement by itself. Mm-hmm. And then say best case, it has controversy around it. Because you can totally see how someone with more ill intent will want to hide underneath this movement to your point, where the end game is actually Israel disappearing.
Yes.
I could totally see that.
Yes.
There's that.
So
there mm-hmm. is the assignation of that movement to what Ben and Jerry specifically is doing, right? In terms of pulling out of Gaza.
Correct.
As where they're selling ice cream. Once again, not saying that they want to pull out of Israel or saying any kind of boycott of Israel.
Right.
Now, they're being clear as to why they do that, mm-hmm. why they're doing that, right? They disagree with the policy. Like, we could be pro-Israel and still disagree with policy that Israel is putting in place, right?
Right.
And the third piece is the state issue of getting involved in this kind of topic.
I know you want to talk about the state issue, and I think that's a really interesting conversation. So just the third part of my calculus is the fact that I actually have physically been in the West Bank, mm-hmm. okay? I've been in Palestine, let's call it that, even though a lot of Jews and Israelis would say that that's not a real thing. Mm-hmm. But like, for instance, Bethlehem, okay? I've been in Bethlehem. Getting to Bethlehem, you arrive, if you take a tour, you arrive on a bus. The bus will then, in our case, was boarded by Palestinian, basically the PLO, I guess, or whatever, the Palestinian Authority. They came in with machine guns, wanted to search everything, look mm-hmm. at everyone. There's about a 30-foot wall that goes all the way around Bethlehem. And I can tell you, because I had conversations with them, anybody who's Christian living in Palestine, they're not having a super fun time, okay? Mm-hmm. So I'm also thinking of that this area of the West Bank has been so, kind of a difficult place, and there's a lot of suffering, and there's a lot of on a lot of sides, right? And so these guys pulling out of that, means more to me because, again, I've personally been there. So all of this, the part I didn't like about it, the part that's like not an easy courage or cringe, or not an easy cringe, sorry, because uh-huh. I do think I net out on courage in terms of them blacklisting Ben and Jerry for their decision. But the thing it wasn't like an exuberant one is because, got to give it up to Ron DeSantis. I mean, this guy is really good at finding every single thing to get involved in to be a headline. Now,
a great run for president.
Well, and that's the thing is like in the, he's really, really good at being front of the news cycle.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's like, does he really care about Ben and Jerry's or the ice cream or this seemingly relatively obscure kind of, what's it called? What's the list called? This, list that they came up with.
The scrutinized companies list?
The scrutinized companies list. I'm not sure. I think that probably he's learned a lot about dominating the news cycle. He may be principled as well, but he's still clearly thinking of the news cycle in my mind when I read this story. And it just smells a little bit like there's some PR and engineering here, which makes it hard for me to like go, oh, it's a definite courage. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's a qualified courage, but I come down on courage for the reasons that I've mentioned, made harder by the fact that I think that there's a lot of PR that's in this thing.
Got it.
That's where I'm at. Okay. We could talk about the state stuff, but that's where I'm at.
So, in looking at this issue, to me, it's I'm hard cringe because it's a non-starter for me that states should be involved in trying to dictate or put pressure on corporations at a global stage on issues that have nothing to do with the state.
Does it change it for you if they're headquartered in their state?
I mean, I guess what I find really interesting here is that these are the same many times players, individuals who are very vocal of wanting to, of pushing back on, again, brands getting blacklisted because of their social positions and or pushing them to get blacklisted if they have the wrong kind of position, right? When MLB decided to pull out of Atlanta, right? There was a lot of, because of their transgender law, I think is what it was, right?
Major League Baseball. It was voting rights.
Sorry. It was something else that wasn't trans. But anyways,
I can't keep track.
There was like all this conversation about Coke as well, and all these brands that should get sort of
Home Depot.
Home Depot should get listed, blacklisted there. And also, you see the opposite of people that are like really are pushing for their a certain brand to get whatever to have economic impact, etc. And I disagree with that, well, that stuff, but I at least if it's within a national scope, that's something that's happening in this country, I could sort of understand it, I sort of get it. But in this case, I think it's a brand that, a lot of people that are in the, to your point, I definitely think it's a PR move. But then again, my orientation with the sense, I think that that's basically, he's been running for presidential election now for a while and doing a pretty good job, jumping on every single talking point. He's going to have a lot to point to. He's going to have some great commercials. I think this move is really a little bit of an FU to the left on a brand that is super, super progressive and a way to jump in there to show a conservative base that you're for it. Having said all that, what bothers me the most is these type of laws that feel like, in my mind, that have no place to be in state's purview, because that's, to me, is like, how are you looking after your constituents by getting involved in this international issue that has nothing to do with anyone that lives in your state?
Right, but okay, let me push back on that though, because on some level, like
federal. I mean, the federal is one thing.
I get it. But I would just distinguish two things. Uh-huh. One is the fact that what they're saying is they are a customer of a company, and they're choosing not to be a customer of a company. Right, that's what they're choosing.
Because
even though they are political players, even though they have influence on the scene, all these other things are true. Nevertheless, what the decision is like, we will no longer patronize you. Right, that's what the decision is actually.
I agree,
being made.
But these are based on laws that you have in place. I guess part of my question would be like, well, why don't you have these kind of laws other international issues?
Maybe your issue is with the law less than what they're actually choosing. Because otherwise, what would be a good reason to choose not to buy something from you? Any reason I can pick to not buy something from you?
I have an issue with these laws altogether state level. That's what I have an issue with, right? Okay. Because I could say, well, why don't you have – maybe there is, by the way. I have no idea. It's the first time I heard of these kind of international laws, right? Like, why don't you have other laws as it relates to like child brides? Right, and not doing any business with any company that has any that operates in those countries that operates here. When I have laws against, I don't know, all kinds of you can think of all the international issues that you could have laws against at a state level.
There
to
are
me,
a
like,
whole bunch of
that's really odd to
there
me.
There are
that you
a whole bunch
that
of
doesn't feel like the right place to have this kind of conversation, and it seems like a really, really odd thing to me altogether.
There are a bunch of obscure laws that states actually do have.
Yeah, I'm sure.
On my
I just have never heard of this, and I was like, super weird.
On my other show, we have the segment at the end that's called Wait What, and I basically ask like these random questions that are based on the guest for that week, right? And so I usually do one about the state they're from. And I had a guest on my show who's from New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And one of the laws on the books in New Mexico is you cannot dance wearing a sombrero. It is illegal in the state of New Mexico to dance with a sombrero on. Now, that law was probably written in like 1780 or something, right, for some reason that we have no idea about. It's never been taken off the books. So there are weird laws on each of these things. And I bet you that there are laws about, you know, child brides and stuff like that. But your point across the board is Israel maybe has a different position. And I agree with you. I think that's due in part to the very specific relationship we've had with Israel as a nation,
yeah, I'm sure,
for
it does,
so many decades, that these states have come up and said, well, wait a minute, we're also pro-Israel, and like, here's what we're going to do, well, in our neck of the woods, because it's good for the economy, and it's
also
maybe
Israel
good for them.
I think also Israel has done a good job in lobbying the different arms of government here in the U.S., for sure.
Probably true as well.
Right?
Every government does
what
that.
What was interesting... Yeah, but they probably did it until a much more successful manner than probably anyone else, is my guess.
Yeah. Right?
Not knowing it. I mean, just this kind of law is like really interesting to me. What's interesting here, it is, you're seeing a change in public opinion, though, where it was, I think, very controversial for anyone to have any kind of view outside of being 100% pro-Israel as it relates to any kind of conflict there, to now you're like, well, wait a minute. Now that you're seeing this area being like really heavy-handedly bombed, and to the point where you're like, yeah, but these guys, like, we begin to get come close. It's like watching a little kid fighting an adult. Like, it gets to a point, like, yeah, even the kid started it. Like, at some point, is, you know, you're fighting a kid. Like, you also have to be the adult in the conversation. And I think you're seeing a shift in public opinion. So, to me, it is really interesting to see this kind of discourse as it relates to Israel specifically because of that shift in public opinion. And I wonder if maybe part of the outcome there would be of having less of these kind of laws. I just find it so weird to have... have this kind of law at a state level. By the way, I frankly don't know enough to agree or disagree with Ben and Jerry. I definitely have your perspective as it relates to, like, I put them in the, to me, Ben Jerry is net neutral. I'm not necessarily for them. I'm not necessarily against them. I don't frankly know enough about what they've, you know, supported or not supported. I know they were super active and proactive about their stance around like Black Lives Matter and everything was happening last year in summer, but it's also very much to their brand, yeah, right? Like, that is what their brand is.
It is, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's the part I guess I never got over, that the state level law for something like this.
Yeah, and to that I can't speak because, I mean, you know, I do believe that the state should be able to do business with whoever they want to do business with, and if they want to say, we're not going to get our ice cream from you if you don't do X, Y, and Z, I mean, I guess that's their prerogative. I think you can still hold the position of saying that brands should not be boycotted in terms of their ability to speak, and also say, I don't want to do business with you. I think those are not mutually exclusive positions. Because I know you said earlier that, like, these are a lot of the same people who begrudge when people criticize, you know, brands or whatever, or when brands have But I think those can be two different things.
Sure.
Anyway. All right. So that's Ron DeSantis.
Ron DeSantis. So our second topic is Courage or Cringe?
Even more fun.
Yeah.
Did you see this movie, by the way?
I have, Black Widow? I just watched it.
You just did. Okay.
I watched it in the theaters because I felt like she wasn't getting enough paid for.
So you gave her your $17.
I wanted to make sure that she got her proper due.
I haven't seen it, so I go into this with full, you know, ignorance with respect to the movie. I have my guesses about what it's like, but you can tell me otherwise.
So yeah, the topic is Scarlett Johansson. Why can I see this?
Sues Disney
for releasing Black Widow in theaters and on Disney Plus.
How dare they?
A hybrid release, which is what they're calling it now.
How dare they?
So Scarlett Johansson, right, the star of the new film Black Widow, right, has sued Disney because they decided to do a hybrid release of the film, once again, in both theatrical and Disney Plus, which she claimed had her lose out on considerable bonuses tied to a theatrical release performance of the film.
So you can imagine that these contracts are probably written something like, if we have a holdover weekend, you get another $5 million. If the movie opens number one in the country or number one in the world, there's a different
there's
thing.
Performance, yeah, bonuses, right?
Based that on are how tied
well,
to...
Yeah, how well they do. And
but specifically tied to a theatrical bow, though, a theatrical
correct.
Open.
Right, okay. right. Theatrical open. And yeah. I think in this case, what's interesting is at least based on how they were all responding to it, it sounds like they would also still give her bonuses tied to... the performance of it on Disney Plus, because the thing here is like it's a little bit different in Disney Plus in the sense that it's not like Netflix, where if it's available on the platform, then people just get to watch it. On Disney Plus, any premier access films are available, but they cost an extra $30.
Which is also literally like a year old thing. I mean, that didn't exist when Disney Plus launched.
Yeah.
I don't think so because they were doing day and date on Pixar releases and things like that.
Yeah, my point on that one is that there is still a performance, I think, bonus for these actors.
Sure.
But they're simply saying by doing that, you are cutting the legs of the theatrical release.
You're giving people one less reason to go to the theater.
Correct.
Right. Okay, now, but here's my question. Do you know enough about the unit economics of theatrical versus home video to say that it is more profitable for Disney if you go to the theater?
In terms of the money for it, I don't. Although my guess is probably significantly more profitable for them. It's a combination of unit versus volume, right? But the thing, and this is what will come up here, we'll talk about, is that right now Disney as a corporation is very motivated to drive subscribers to Disney Plus, and the more subscriber growth they can create on that platform, the more their stock price will go up. And using a film like Black Widow
to me makes a lot of sense
to drive subs has a direct benefit to Disney, not just on the individual property, but as a company as a whole, which is basically the argument that their lawyers are making.
But her argument is not that Disney Plus was part of the agreement. It's just the degree to which they promoted like the theatrical and the Disney Plus.
Her argument is that in her contract, she's saying that it was agreed to that it was going to be a theatrical-only release.
Got it. Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
So, yeah, I think that's what it was. Now, keep in mind, this is a film that got pushed back over a year, right? It got, or maybe exactly a year. It was supposed to be released in May of 2020, but, of course, with the pandemic, everything else was obviously pushed back. Now, the film itself, which, once again, I watched, and I got to be honest, I liked it a lot. I thought it was really good. I liked it a lot. Mm. It's okay. I liked it. Thought it was good. Mm-hmm. I thought the new actress that came in, that plays her younger sister, I thought she had the best role in the movie.
Okay.
So it's one of those films where it's a clear baton being handed off to the next generation. So I thought that was good. There's a lot about the story that I actually liked.
Okay.
So anyways. But the movie has grossed more than $200 million worldwide during its opening weekend.
Probably cost $300 million to make, but go ahead.
No idea. Yeah. I actually didn't see that. I'm sure that someone has reported it.
We'll see.
Including $80 million in the U.S. theatrical box office and $60 million via Disney Plus, right? So that gives a little bit of the economics there, right?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what was generated there. Now, the film itself has experienced a significant drop-off in the following weeks, right? Now, in the lawsuit, they stated, right, this is in Johansson's lawsuit, said Disney intentionally included Marvel's breach of the agreement. Intentionally induced Marvel's breach of the agreement without justification in order to prevent Ms. Johansson from realizing the full benefit of her bargain with Marvel.
Hmm.
Right? Now, sources told the Wall Street Journal, who broke the story, that she could stand to lose upwards to $50 million in bonuses over the move.
Production budget is estimated at $200 million, just production.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Marketing, probably another 75 if you figure just based on what we know.
Yeah, so it's probably break even, right, at the end of the day when this thing is all said and done. Because if it's $200 million in just opening weekend, maybe a little better than that, right? So we'll see. So what's interesting is, so it says, in addition, the suit stated that Disney chose to placate Wall Street investors and pad its bottom line rather than allow its subsidiary Marvel to comply with the agreement. To no one's surprise, Disney breach of agreement successfully pulled millions of fans away from the theaters and towards its Disney Plus streaming service. Now, in her suit, Scarlett Johansson maintained that Disney declined to renegotiate her deal after the decision was made to send the movie to both theaters and Disney Plus, despite repeated attempts on her part to open those discussions.
Do you think that there's any chance, any at all, knowing what we know about contracts, especially something like this, that there's not some clause in that agreement that says we can put this movie anywhere we want? At our sole discretion.
I'm sure there is some of that. I think the part where it will get tricky is you're gonna get into like the spirit of the agreement kind of conversation. I also think that Disney is pretty motivated to drive Disney Plus subscription, and you're still talking about a film that is now over a year old that you're trying to like get out with frankly a talent that is at the end of your agreement with them. So there is no...
Well, now the very end of it, probably.
Yeah. But I'm saying, like, if it was, like, the first of this or, like, an ongoing franchise, you know, is one thing. Now, to that point, Disney did not stay quiet about the suit, right? They said and I quote, the loss was especially sad and distressing in its callous disregard for the horrific and prolonged global effects of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Disney, they went there right away. I was like,
get out of here. Disney has fully complied with Ms. Johansson's contract. And furthermore, the release of Black Widow on Disney Plus Premier Access has significantly enhanced her ability to earn additional compensation on top of the $20 million she has received to date. The fact that they called out how much she made.
Let me tell you something. This is like, we don't care if we ever work with you again, lady. That's what this says. I mean, seriously, read between the lines. You know how many layers?
That's super terrible, yeah.
Think how many layers of approval that thing had to go through before it hit the...
For sure, right?
Are you kidding me? You know the CEO probably saw that before it went out.
Yeah.
He's okay with saying, dumping the pandemic on her and saying, you need to make more than $20 million?
Right.
So everybody in middle America knows that you're complaining about the fact that you didn't make more than $20 million
to be
in a movie.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a super bold, super bold move. Now, adding to this was Johansson's agent and the co-chair of Hollywood CAA, the powerhouse CAA, Brian Lurd, who basically fired back and said, look, that Disney shamelessly and falsely accused Ms. Johansson of being insensitive to the global COVID pandemic in an attempt to appear to be something they and I know she isn't. And also, Disney intentionally induced Marvel's breach of agreement without justification in order to prevent Ms. Johansson from realizing the full benefit of her bargain with Marvel, right? It says Scarlett has been Disney's partner on 9 movies, which
and
have earned
there won't
Disney
be a tenth.
And its shareholder billions.
I'm sure that's
right?
true.
And the
and
company
made her
included,
hundreds of millions.
That's right. The company included her salary in its press statement in an attempt to weaponize her success as an artist and businesswoman.
Not really. You think it was weaponizing her success, or it was
yes.
just kind of
for 1,000%.
But you view that as
1,000%. Yeah.
But you would classify that as weaponizing success as opposed to trying to embarrass her by virtue of how much money she made.
Both to me, that's two
same
sides
thing.
Of the coin. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Interesting.
Because the reaction you just said is like, wait, you can make about $20 million?
And you're complaining.
And you're complaining. Is like, yeah, from a company that makes billions of dollars.
Right. So that's...
Whose stock price will generate billions of dollars based on bringing in more subscribers to... So it's all relative,
when
right?
I think about weaponizing, I think of attacking people other than the participants in the story is what I mean. So like in this case...
Oh, yeah. I guess
it's
I see
like a
weaponizing
self-weaponization
as,
sort
weaponizing
of.
Yeah. And basically she's saying if that were something that she should be ashamed of. And it is, I think to me, when you put it out there, you are making the case. It's like, you should be glad we gave you this money. Like, what are you talking about? Right? But any case, there's a lot to this conversation. So courage or cringe.
I wish I had seen the movie.
Elitist sour grapes for not making millions more, or corporation using COVID as an excuse to breach contract that drove subscriptions and increase their share price.
Wow. You want to go first? You want me to go first?
All right, go ahead.
Mixed feelings on this one. The first thought that came to me was, you know, the revolution kind of eats itself. You have all these people just going back and forth and, you know, eating each other's lunch back and forth. Tells me that they have really no interest in working with her again, just given how kind of vocal this thing is.
Yeah.
And I also, you know... Part of the problem is I worked at Disney for years and I know the way that these contracts are written. I find it extremely hard to believe that they let themselves be limited to only a theatrical release of this thing. I mean, I remember reading these contracts and it would literally, the section on platforms would mention the word universe, literally that exists now, in the past, will ever exist. Now or in the future, almost like they
but you
like,
think that would be the case in a Marvel movie? Like, if this, you think they would do this to Robert Downey Jr.? There is no way, Charlie.
What I'm saying is, I don't believe that they would write a contract that says we don't have the right to distribute it in whatever way we want. And even if they did write the only theatrical, which I don't believe, but let's say they did, there's still clauses in contracts, and those contracts called force majeure, which is an act of God under which a global pandemic falls, which makes a lot of the foregoing things null and void, right? So there is in the contract,
yeah,
you agree
that.
To
it's...
acts of God.
I think the part that I have a hard time, any pandemic conversation here is like, get out of here. You delayed the launch of this film to allow for theatrical release by over a year. If really all you cared about is saying, hey, I don't want to put anyone in harm, why did you even do a theatrical release to begin with?
Mm-hmm.
It should have been all on Disney Plus. A year ago.
No, they would have still gotten sued then. But what difference does that make?
But yeah, but then COVID had nothing to do with it. And you waited to be able to allow to be able to put this in theaters.
Yeah, look, personally,
while the pandemic is still happening. So obviously you don't really care that much that the pandemic is happening.
I really wish I'd seen the movie. Do you really think it's a very good movie? Do you honestly believe that?
I think it's a good movie, yeah.
You
I
do.
Think it's a good movie.
Okay, because by the looks of it, I would
I think it's better than Iron Man 3, for sure.
Okay, I have to watch it. It's really unfair for me to say this, but the impression that I get is that it's not a good movie. That's the impression I get from the lack of kind of conversation and maybe buzziness and everything else about it.
I guess being a good or bad movie, what does that have to do with
I think that there's other things at play here besides the fact that there's a venue discussion on whether or not it's theatrical or otherwise. I think they shelved the movie for a number of reasons, including the fact that they weren't as confident as they were.
Yeah. So your point is they kind of don't care because
I'm agreeing with you that there was other things.
It's an artist that you're that's basically your franchise with them. It's probably coming to an end. And then two, a film that maybe you didn't love or think is not going to be as good. So therefore, you're okay burning the bridge on both ends.
Something like that. Yeah. I think that there's more here at play. And I do think it's the pot calling the kettle black in terms of, you know, hey, you're making $20 million. $20 million is like, you know, that probably is the amount that Disney spent on like coasters for their movie production sets. It's a lot of money to people like, you know, you and me and anybody listening here. But you know, in the scheme of what these properties actually make and what the companies actually make, it is a drop in the bucket, right? So there is that intent to kind of shame her and all that other stuff.
Yeah.
Think
with this. Do you think they would handle the same if it was Robert Downey Jr.? Even if let's listen to two things. Last film with him, and you realize maybe not the best one.
After Dr. Doolittle, I think probably they probably would do it. I mean, but in his prime, 10 years ago, maybe not. 10 years ago, maybe not.
Yeah, in the context of Marvel and what it means for Disney.
Yeah. Look, him, I mean, newsflash, there's ageism in Hollywood. Scarlett Johansson's almost 40 years old. Like, how many Avenger movies is she going to be making? I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, there's all these things that are at play.
Yeah.
So I think that they're... Okay, look, I'm going to come down... Oh, man, this one sucks.
I think you're, like, changing your mind back and forth.
I am, because I think they're both kind of ridiculous. I do think that it is a bit vile to throw this woman under the bus that way and blame COVID on her and all this other stuff. At the same time, I do think, like, I mean, how many yachts can you ski behind kind of thing, right? That line from Wall Street, 20 million, 25 million. I get it. It's 5 more million. But at the same time,
if you're Disney,
what damage are you doing to your own brand, Scarlett?
Your park's all open. Like, you don't really care about COVID that much.
Yeah.
If you really care about, if COVID really was your number one priority,
yeah.
Why are your parks open? Why are you doing any theatrical releases whatsoever? It's like, that's what, like, the whole COVID thing.
All right,
I'm
going to go courage because I lately dislike Disney more than I do dislike Scarlett Johansson. So I'm going to go courage on her suing, but it's a very qualified one. I think that there's so much, you know, back and forth on this. I'd love to have the contract and read it. I find that the claims that Scarlett Johansson's team making is dubious. I think Disney is, and you can tell by their posture, they're like, bring it. And I think Disney will win, ultimately.
This is the kind of thing where even if Disney wins, it's just not a good look for them altogether as it relates to dealing with artists.
I don't think anybody cares. I mean, I don't think it matters to them that for this.
Yeah,
this
maybe it doesn't. But, I mean, the thing, too, is, like, she's a big star. She's still a big star. Maybe she's come to the end of that rope with them.
A superhero is what I mean.
Yeah. For right, but it's I don't know. Like I have a hard time feeling bad for money lost by Disney or them claiming that amount of money that an artist has made
is enough.
Right, like it's enough. Like we should be happy with them. Like, and the whole COVID. To me, maybe the biggest trigger was the COVID thing. It's like, get out of here. Like, you Disney, really? Like, this is stuff that's keeping you up at night. Like, get out of here. You know, you're taking that kind of position. And I do think, though, there is major incentives for them to try to bring up their stock price on driving a subscription. Even though I wholeheartedly disagree with their model of you subscribe and still have to pay $30 to watch a movie. Right?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I think it is That's insane. Crazy. And yet I just did it for Jungle what Princess. Happens? What's it called? What Jungle Cruise.
Something with a strong slate.
Yeah.
I don't know how you pay $30 for that movie. Jungle Cruise, really, Charlie? And you're talking smack about...
Let me tell you something. I agree with you. I'm not... After having seen it, I would probably have rather seen Black Widow. We'll talk about that one next time.
That's
funny.
Yeah,
look, callous disregard for the horrific prolonged global effects of the COVID pandemic. It's like, whoa.
Get out of here. Get out of here.
All we're trying to do is save lives. And yeah, here all exactly. you're worried about is your stupid bonus. Your bonus. Right. By the way, it does bring up an interesting question, though, mm-hmm. about like... I remember when, or like, think of it this way. Think of an NFL contract. Mm-hmm. NFL contracts have bonuses for touchdowns.
Yeah.
They have bonuses for interceptions, things like that. But if the coach doesn't put you in, you're not getting any of those bonuses, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So someone on the Disney side could say, you're suing us for bonuses you didn't get for a decision we took that were within our rights to take.
Yeah, but that's where the language of the agreement will kick into place, right? Where that's to be sort of like, hey, I also have to have the chance to play in the team. You can't just bench me. Like, see what I'm saying? Like it's different in the case of sports because that is a that's the rules that they all under operated. But I bet for some of these players, I bet there's a thing here that you also can't like
unreasonably withhold
someone from playing because you could say, hey, I'm gonna bench you the last three games because we're doing really well in our, and I have to pay you. And I bet in those cases you could probably sue them.
Mm. Or there's already a clause for that.
Or there's some kind of clause. I'm sure that has been considered. Because if you're an agent, you have to be like, and you have a player like that that can do that, you know, you have to consider the stuff.
If anybody ever wants to seriously lose some IQ points or just go numb from the neck down or neck up, read any of these contracts. I mean, these things are so exhaustive. That's why I find it so hard to believe. These things are like 100 pages.
Yeah.
And it's like, even though we said X, we still don't mean X in these 500 different scenarios. And even when we do, I mean, right. it's a calculus problem. I've read these contracts.
I think the interesting thing here will be is to, the degree that these kind of agreements need to be re-looked at, or even how you think about distribution strategy for these films, right? You're seeing, you know, these hybrid releases by some. You also seen the opposite, right? And I was telling you this, like, so I drive by or run by literally the Sony studio almost on a daily basis. And they, in their billboards for their films, they specifically put out only in theaters or for theatrical release. And that's becoming like a stamp of... Like as a, you know, like what makes this more exclusive? You can't just get this in one of your platforms. And that to me, I've never seen it before. Yeah. It caught my attention that I like.
Kind
like
of ironic too, in a way, right? Because the theater experience is the one that's dying, and now it's the premium, right? It's like the thing that everyone
right.
wants.
Right, it's like, it's really interesting.
We don't want to be in your stupid living room. Come to the theater.
Exactly.
All right, part three.
Last one here, Courage or Cringe, Spotify's CEO doesn't believe the platform has editorial responsibility over podcasts.
Oh, Spotify.
Our boys from Spotify. So Daniel Ek, the CEO of podcast, was recently of...
Spotify, is it Danish
CEO
or Swedish?
Spotify, I don't know what to call it, CEO of podcast.
Where are they based again? Spotify, Danish, Swedish. You know? They're Swedish.
Or Swedish? Okay.
They're Swedish, yeah. He's a Swedish guy.
Yeah, so Daniel, like the CEO of Spotify, was mm-hmm. recently interviewed by Axios, where he was asked whether the company should have editorial responsibility over podcasts like Joe Rogan, right? To which, you know, he responded that he does not believe that Spotify should have editorial control. And to this, he added, "We have a lot of really well-paid rappers on Spotify, too, that make tens of millions of dollars, if not more, each year from Spotify. And we don't dictate what they're putting in their songs either."
Can I stop right there on that one? Okay. True, but it is verbatim, literally verbatim, Joe Rogan's argument.
Yes.
So you can tell there's a little bit of collusion. And it's a hairbreadth. Well, it's a hair no, but it's also kind of a hairbreadth, like slightly racist too, in a way, right? It's like nobody said we have lots of rock songs
right.
or whatever. So A, you're making an assumption that all rap is black, number one. And number two, that only vulgarities that are objectionable to the point of requiring editorial consent would be in rap songs. Or editorial control rather would be in rap songs. Why not just mention music? You say rappers.
Right,
like, it's interesting.
Right.
And by the way, there is a lot of foul language in rap music. I'm not saying there isn't, but I'm just saying it's interesting that it's the exact same argument. And on top of that, it's like nobody has a problem with them saying it's like just rapping. There's a lot of crap that's foul mouth that's out there.
That is. And it's just, it is a soundbite. And I think at this point, it's like Joe Rogan is dictating what the soundbites are for the CEO of Spotify. Good for him, man. Like, that dude has put us in a really, you know, really good position.
Here's what's interesting. Maybe the guy's a genius because he knows it's exactly Rogan's argument. And anybody who's heard that argument from Rogan doesn't have a problem with Rogan. So therefore, the only people who haven't heard that argument are people who have a problem with Rogan. Therefore, I'll use it. It's actually could be pretty genius. It might be 3D chess.
I think what's going to be interesting is how he deals with it, which is kind of what we're going to get into, is like how he deals with it with internal employees, because that's where the pressure he's going to get. Now, Rogan, as a reminder, signed a $100 million deal back in May of 2020, right? To make the Joe Rogan Experience exclusively available on Spotify, which they did, and it started at the end of 2020, right? Now, that move, of course, did not come without controversy, as last year, and we talked about this here, there was a number of times where Spotify employees were, you know, basically semi-protesting, right? Expressing a lot of concern over the material in this podcast that they felt was anti-transgender and or other complaints against some of the other content that he had, right? Now some of the more controversial episodes included one with Abigail Schreier, who's the author of Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters, and InfoWars owner Alex Jones, who, you know, talks a lot about coronavirus and misinformation on the podcast, right?
Although at this point with misinformation on coronavirus, I don't know if anybody can actually say that about this. It's like, you know, it is, it's from a lab. It's not from a lab.
Yeah.
You can, you don't spread coronavirus once you've been vaccinated. You do spread coronavirus once you've been vaccinated. I mean, so.
That's fair. I'm not going to argue that, Charlie. I'm not going to argue
this
that.
This is not about Alex Jones.
It's not about Alex Jones.
It's about misinformation of coronavirus. Go ahead.
Even Joe Rogan himself has come under some scrutiny for his comments regarding the vaccine, which he said that young, healthy people didn't need to take the vaccine, something that he then later on came out and backtracked on, right? So he's getting some kind of pressure, right? But so as it relates to this, look, this is a short and sweet, but probably lots to talk about as we've talked about, you know, more in the context of social platforms. But here, Courage or Cringe, Spotify leadership solidifying their stance and letting creators create, or CEO passing the buck to consumers for having to navigate between fact and fiction?
You know, the two things that I think are really interesting about this is, one is the fact that Daniel Ek is equating a podcast with music. I think that distinction, there's two important things. That's one. So podcast equals music for the purposes of his editorial consideration. Interesting. Mm-hmm. The second one is, by arguing that they don't have editorial control over either, they're kind of making a platform argument, right?
They're absolutely making a platform argument.
In a situation where they are the exclusive owners of a piece of content that is in question largely. There may be other things, but this is about Rogan, let's face it.
Yeah.
This is about Rogan.
Yeah.
I find that very difficult to make that argument logically. Okay, number one is, I don't think podcasts as a format are music. I think music is art, okay? We have our definitions of what art is. I don't think all music is art, because I think art should pull you towards something transcendent. But nevertheless, that's just for me. Where I think podcasts can run a bunch of different genres and gamuts, and you can have journalism, you can have whatever. Number one. Number two is, I don't think Spotify is a kind of phone company type platform, and I don't think you can make that case. And then furthermore, I think it's the fact that Joe Rogan is exclusive means by definition only they can have control over it. If it was everywhere else, I could see you making that because, like, listen, this is it's electricity.
Right, right.
It's oxygen. Like, we have oxygen in our conference room and you have it in Google's conference room. We all have oxygen. But this is only on Spotify. And so they go, yeah, we're not responsible. Sorry. So as much as I believe that Joe Rogan should be left alone and nobody should mess with his show, I think I come down on Cringe on this.
What?
Because
I'm very shocked.
I just don't think that you can make that argument with a straight face as he has. And I think that's what we're Courage or Cringing. And it's hard for me to be there, but I kind of think it's Cringe. Talk me out of it. Am I wrong?
No, I'm not going to talk you out of it. I think that the whole argument that because we don't tell rappers, which I love that, what to say in their songs, we shouldn't be able to dictate what anyone else is saying as the justification. I just think it's a dumb argument to think of it that way, because then you're not giving the right weight to the importance of actually thinking about something that falls within the entertainment and information, which is pure entertainment, right? I think when we were kind of teeing up for this thing, I mentioned to you, like, look at, like, saying that, hey, if I'm not gonna tell a filmmaker what he can write a script about and put a movie in my platform, I'm also not gonna tell someone that that my breaking news or my news segments what they can do. And I just think those are two different things. They're two very different types of content. If he really wants, if he thinks like, hey, I feel that Joe Rogan, I support what he's saying, and I don't want to dictate what he says in our platform, and I will bear whatever responsibility comes from that, I'm okay with that. if that's what he's saying, right? But his argument as to why he feels that he shouldn't be, to your point, being a pure platform argument, I don't think it makes any sense, especially in the context that what they're doing is going down this road of all exclusivity across the board and all these different kind of content.
Like your exclusivity,
it's really hard to make that argument where you could only make it see it in this platform.
It's almost like exclusivity. It's like it's inversely proportional, right? The degree to which you have exclusivity, or actually no, it's directly proportional. The degree that you have exclusivity is the degree to which editorial considerations are brought to bear. Like almost equally.
Even think of it this way. Like at that point, what distinguishes exclusivity versus an original versus Spotify original? Like if we didn't, I mean, in terms of for the consumer.
Nothing. It's right? Just, like, it's only available here. That's the consumer value prop. That's all I care about.
So
where do I get it here?
Right. So from a consumer perspective, the content that you're making available only here versus you creating it yourself.
It's a distinction without a difference.
There you go. So I think for that reason, I don't see as he. I don't see them being able to just simply wash their hands from having any say whatsoever. I'm okay with them saying I don't want to tell them what to say.
I'm okay.
And whatever happens. But I believe strong enough in, you know, freedom of speech and their freedom to say things. And if we end up getting whatever hit one way or the other because of that, I'm okay with that. Right. I believe that strongly in the voice that creators to have in these platforms. And I'm going to be that, you know, that place where they can have their voice. I'm okay with that.
And I think that's my point is I think he almost is arguing too much. I think he's going too far in the direction of, and it makes his position a bit like untenable. Right. If he had said what you said, which is like, look, we're not going to touch the show. That's the deal we made with this guy. And further, it kind of accords with how I feel about the world that we shouldn't be telling people what to create. If you don't want to be a customer, God bless you. Right. That's consistent.
Yeah, I'm like, okay, well, all right. I may agree or may not, but like that makes sense. Yeah,
cancel my subscription maybe. Okay, fine.
Yeah, sure. But I think that makes sense. And this tied to like rap, right? Like picking on rappers as being the only ones. It is kind of hilarious. But yeah, that's why to me, I'm very cringe on this one for that reason. I really wish he would just come out and just say it. But I do find it hilarious, what to your point is like he's using literally the talking points from Joe Rogan. So you know at that point who's you know, which is the tail, which is the dog? Who's wagging whom at that point, right? As it relates to Spotify?
They definitely have been talking, I would say, on some level, or at least through some interlocutors. But interesting. I'm sure there'll be more to come on that. All right. Jesus, anything else? We got an exciting show next week?
Yes. We have Lucy Flores, CEO of Loose Collective. Will be on the show and we're excited to talk to her.
She's, I believe, was the first Latina elected to the Nevada State Assembly too, representing the 28th district. So somebody to contrast our last
week's
going guess
through,
what Joe Collins.
Our list of politicians now.
Right.
This is like a new era for us. I'm excited about that.
And we tried to find politicians who could not be further apart from one another as back-to-back guests on the show. So yeah, so stay tuned for Lucy coming on the show. Looking forward to that very much and all their exciting episodes to come. Keep listening. Please remember to check out www.patreon.com/thediversityremix. Subscribe to this show, share it with your friends. We keep doing what we're doing. And we'll see you again next time on another episode of TDR. If you enjoyed this episode of the Diversity Remix, please remember, first of all, to subscribe and help us to spread the word. Tell your friends, family, coworkers, and give us a 5-star review. We're available on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else you get your listening fix. And lastly, please remember to stop by blackbrown.us, the creator of this podcast, and take a look at our work and our approach at the intersection of diversity and business. The Diversity Remix is produced by Leo Gomez, with production services by Jose Manuel Durquidi and Luis Diego Carranza and our friends at Juan Diego Network. The Diversity Remix is a production of Black Brown.